No.
Capital Investments Committee will come to order. Representative Uecom is not here, and so we'll take the second item on the agenda. Representative Hausman, will you help us out? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. You have before you a handout that looks like this, which is a good introduction to our first bill. You are going to hear, in the two bills that I have, two amazing organizations led by two amazing leaders who are doing great things to transform this part of our world. And you notice that if you see this handout, their theme, everyone deserves the chance to live well and work well. And Avivo deals with some of the most vulnerable people facing huge challenges, and they bring them to a better place in life. And there is housing on their campus, and they are patient and give people some time. So if there is a single mother with children, she doesn't have just 90 days to transform her life. She has a year or two to be there in that supporting environment. I'm joined by Kelly Matter, President and CEO of Avivo.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Matter.
Thank you, Chairman Murphy, members of the committee, and particularly to Representative Hausman for chief authoring our bill. For the record, my name is Kelly Matter, and I'm the President and CEO of Avivo. And I'm here today seeking an appropriation from the bond proceeds to fund a grant to Hennepin County for phase one of an enhancement and an expansion project of our regional career and treatment campus based in Minneapolis. For those of you that are not familiar with Avivo, we are a 58-year-old organization. We serve 18,000 people annually in 17 counties across 25 locations in the Twin Cities Metro, St. Cloud, and Princeton. We provide chemical and mental health treatment and support. We provide housing services and support. We're a licensed post-secondary school providing career training with and for business partners, and we provide employment services. We connect approximately 5,000 individuals to employment every year. We connect over 500 individuals who have experienced chronic homelessness to housing every year. And we graduate over 1,000 individuals from our intensive outpatient treatment program with housing supports. As Representative Hausman said, we serve people that are experiencing multiple systemic barriers to education, employment, and well-being. We're serving individuals who are experiencing homelessness, joblessness, long-term extreme poverty, people who have experienced multiple traumas, history of incarceration, long-term reliance on public assistance, illness, disabilities, and other barriers. Yet every day I get the opportunity to speak with, meet with, and talk with the people that we serve, hundreds of people that seek us out every single day to change their lives. People are choosing our services to start a very different path toward success, whatever that may mean for them. It could be gaining sobriety, it could be going back to school, finding a job, or many times a whole new career. Today I'm here to talk about the desperate need to improve and expand our central campus located in Minneapolis. Our main facility serves thousands of individuals every year, and after 58 years of heavy traffic, it's taken a toll on the space, along with the actual age of the building has created demand for substantial capital improvement. Put simply, our main facility no longer meets the needs of the people we serve, and it certainly does not reflect the quality of our services. Avivo partners with many, many community organizations. We partner with the state of Minnesota. We partner with federal programs. And Hennepin County has been a very, very long-term supporter and partner of Avivo's. And their board has agreed to support our efforts through fiscal sponsorship. We're addressing the most significant needs of their community and state around the opioid crisis, around the significant labor shortage that employers are experiencing, and around the housing gap in our state as well. We're an essential community partner, but we do need to expand and enhance our main campus facilities to continue to respond and meet the ongoing needs of our community. So the next, I'm just going to briefly share a couple quick slides to illustrate the need, or I guess as the saying goes, a picture says a thousand words, highlighting the needs for our upgrades and expansion. So we have a 60-year-old boiler, we have a 60-year-old chiller, and virtually every inch of our space is 60 years old. We have had great partnerships, pro bono work with great partners like HGA Architects, who have helped us do as much as we can with paint to put the building together, but we paint no longer will meet our needs. You can see, you know, the cement is cracking, we've got old windows, everything is 60 years old. The lower picture shows where over the years, as the needs of our community changed and as we updated our services, we put walls up maybe where they didn't belong. There's about two light switches in this entire building. The building is either turned on or off. You can see this light in the lower corner shows the wall going through the light. That actually goes to my office that does not have a light switch in it. So there's much energy efficiencies that can be, you know, made with these upgrades and improvements as well.
We've
got the luxury of many wonderful partnerships. Part of it is through the career education work we do. We've had a long-term partnership with many labor organizations. As I mentioned, HGA and others have been supportive of us and putting the numbers together to realize what this work will cost. The elevator, the 6-year-old elevator, did die this past year in 2018, and we are at risk of the chiller and the other infrastructure items going as well. This picture is 4 years ago. Avivo purchased this blighted building next to us to provide us the opportunity to expand our services. So our goal is to ultimately double the current space that we have. This building is adjacent to our main campus. We're asking for phase one support to start this work. It would include demolishing this lovely building, doing the site environmental investigation work, and then working to pre-design and design the enhanced and the expanded campus. With that, if there's any questions, I would be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Ms. Matters. Does Avivo stand for something? I mean, other than helping people?
I should have mentioned, for many years, we were known as Resource, and we were known as four divisions of our services: Recovery Resource Center, Spectrum Community Mental Health, Employment Action Center, and Minnesota Resource Center. And we rebranded to Avivo in October of 2017. And Vivo, in Latin and Greek, means life and to live life fully. We added the A to get to the top of the search engine and to be unique.
Okay. Then please clarify for me that phase one is planning and design?
Planning, design, demolition, and site work, correct.
Okay. Then where does the boiler and the chiller come in and the lighting?
Then we're in the midst of starting a campaign and would go into a full effort, seek additional bonding support to renovate and expand our building.
Okay.
And but baby steps first.
And these buildings that were, you're asked for phase one, how many acres of land is there?
You know, that is, I don't know the exact acres. In your packet, you do have a campus map that illustrates our locations on this campus. Okay. I can get back to Representative Houseman with an exact acreage. I don't know the answer to that off the top of my head.
And so do you anticipate that the design work will recommend building of one building or several buildings?
One. If you see this picture that's on the screen now, on the lower right hand is our current building. We would enhance that. And then to the left is a new building on the site of the AAA Daily Labor Building. So it would be one building added.
And there's housing in that building as well as treatment rooms and leisure activities.
Yes, plus we would consolidate. We have the Avivo Institute for Career and Technical Education that is located on 27th Avenue in Minneapolis. We would like to consolidate that into this expanded building as well.
Thank you.
And, Madam Chair, they do have on their campus, they've saved a number of the wonderful old brick buildings that provided housing in past generations. And they're what we call naturally occurring affordable housing. And sometimes we lose that to developers, but you have saved really wonderful old brick structures that have been converted to apartments with the help of labor groups and others who've done some of the pro bono work.
Yeah, just this summer, Avivo has five apartment buildings that we've either owned or master leased for individuals in our in residential and outpatient treatment. Over 90% are homeless when they start our treatment program, so their ability to recover without the housing we provide, it just simply would not happen. We were master leasing four units, or four buildings this summer. We're at risk of losing two of them. Our landlord was selling all of his real estate, and we're in a desirable location between Abbott and HCMC. We purchased the two buildings. It was 20 units of housing. And then through a partnership with the Builders Association of the Twin Cities and their build partners, they have completely renovated one of our apartment buildings for women and children. Every single unit has been renovated through the generous donations of build partners that are members of the Builders Association of the Twin Cities.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any other questions on 599? Representative Self.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just I've heard your presentation before. Obviously, other years you've been here to bring this case before us. How is the arc of services or the arc of your business, if you will, how is that being impacted relative to the timing of this physical building issue?
Yeah, we're not able to meet the entire demand for our intensive outpatient treatment programs because we don't have the space for doing that. Also, the consolidation of bringing our career education programming on-site to this one location would allow us to serve more people in our treatment and recovery programming in our workforce, career education and training programs.
And, Madam Chair, I think the other part of your question, what's going to happen to your service while the construction is going on?
So our goal, and again, we need this kind of pre-design and design work, but our goal would be that we move our current services into the new building on the left, or that we build that, move in there, and then renovate the existing building. Yeah, this would not require us, to lease or locate outside of our campus. Where we're located is essential to our services.
And Ms. Matters, do you have, you said this would be phase one design. Is there anticipation of phase two or phase three or what? How many phases?
And that's what this kind of pre-design ask is for, is to help us lay out the next phases of the project.
Thank you very much.
Thank you all.
Representative Hausman. House file, 5598. Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. You have some handouts, I think, in your packet on this as well. And I don't know if they have the PowerPoint in there. Do you have the PowerPoint?
Yeah.
And so I'll introduce this one again by saying an incredible organization that's been around for 100 years and now led by a remarkable leader that has brought great success. And their theme on the first slide, New Americans Believe in the American Dream, We Help Them Achieve It. And they have had enormous success. The International Institute, by the way, I should, if any of you have been to the State Fair, you may have seen their building. It is on Como Avenue right across from the State Fairgrounds. They provide comprehensive services to new Americans. They train and place students in the workforce, contributing strong workers with high retention rates. 94% end up in health care. That has tended to be a priority for them. The project is shovel-ready. The design is complete. The construction firm is selected. They're ready to begin the project. They've raised $4 million of the $5.5 million they need. They continue to raise the rest with strong community interest and support. As the previous bill, they have remarkable partnerships with, among other things, St. Paul College, and I believe also Roseville Area High School. So there are just really a number of strong partnerships. And here is how they will use the space. Most of the space will be used for workforce training programs, which is a strength of the Institute. You know that as students move through our education system, they sometimes arrive at college and discover they're not prepared, and they have to take a course that they have to pay for. And that is the specialty that the Institute has figured out, to prepare, to assure that the new Americans they're working with are prepared for college the day they arrive, and they help with all of that. Most of the space will be used, as I said, for workforce training, college prep classrooms, and English classrooms. So there will be 5 new classrooms. And then most importantly, this is the Institute's first bonding request. They turned 100 this year, and they will not be coming back anytime soon for another project. I think they're getting their PowerPoint set up.
I think you're right. Representative Considine.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Murphy. You mentioned that a lot of them, majority of them, are going into medical careers. In what capacity?
Well, I can just tell you from my perspective, because I have 2 long-term care facilities, Linglemston, I believe, and St. Anthony Park Home. I think 85% of our employees in those 2 homes have come through your program. But she can speak to other health care careers, too.
Yeah, I do have a slide on that in my presentation.
Excuse me. Please identify yourself.
Sure. I'm Jane Grotman, the Executive Director of the International Institute in Minnesota. Welcome, Chair Murphy. It's a pleasure, and members of the committee, it's a pleasure to be here. To answer your question, we have employed 2,700, a little over 2,700 new Americans in healthcare over the last 20 years. 2,200 of them nursing assistants, and then almost 500 have moved into nursing positions.
Little plug for my bill then. Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a bill to raise home health aides and personal care attendants, and it would seem a lot of these people are initially starting in that field.
Yes, most of them are starting as nursing assistants. Yes.
Oh, good.
Thanks for the question. Yes, and one of our graduates is here to speak also. So. So the Institute is a nonprofit. We're located, as Alice has said, in St. Paul across from the State Fair. You'll hear more about that because we have a very strong partnership with the State Fair. Our mission is to help new Americans achieve self-sufficiency and become fully contributing members in our community. And we see that every day at our agency. So in our last fiscal year, we served close to 4,000 new Americans. We have a broad range of services, comprehensive services. They're also deep services, I would add. So workforce development, as Alice said, is a strength of ours. We have, I'll show you that in our next slide, the career pathway work that we do has gotten national and local recognition. We provide English classes, of course, for new Americans, but also really deep college preparation courses. And immigration assistance for people. Last year, we helped almost 1,500 new Americans become U.S. citizens. And then Refugee Service is a smaller part of our work, but we do have official contract with the U.S. State Department, meet refugees at the airport, help them get into new housing, and then help them get connected to the labor force. So to talk a little bit more about our healthcare services. So one of our pathways, our longest running pathways, is our medical careers pathway. So as I said, we've employed over 2,700 people. And what we're really proud of is to help people move from a wage as a nursing assistant from $14.38 an hour into a wage of almost $30 an hour, and some of them more. So that really does help people have a family-sustaining wage. And many of our graduates have two folks, and Denise is an example of that, that are working in the healthcare field, that both of their parents have been through the program. Really remarkable statistic that we love to share with people. So we track one-year retention data. At 1 year of employment, 94% of our nursing assistants are still employed with the same employer. So that really has a dramatic change for people's business model and really does help provide continuity of care for elders in our community. For our nurses, we have 100% placement rate and about 100% retention rate at 1 year. And we work with over really closer to 100 employer partners in long-term care and in hospital partners. This is a picture of one of our graduates from our hospitality careers pathway, which is a newer pathway. So it helps primarily women who have not been in the country for a long time and are building their English skills to enter the labor force quickly, to get those job skills, also learn the power of learning a paycheck and what that can do to support your family, and just build that confidence and those skills. And so they enter as housekeepers, most of them, and then our work is really helping to build up the higher part of the pathway for them to become supervisors in that field and to go into other higher paying positions. So in the last, since 2012, the number of programs that we have at the Institute has tripled. Our workforce development programs have grown. We have anti-human trafficking services, both labor and sex trafficking services, and that program has really grown. Our mental health services have expanded. And we've also doubled the number of staff that we have at the Institute to provide those services. So we're here before you today because we're out of space at the Institute, and it's limiting our ability to do the current services that we have and also to grow the services that we have. So our budget for our expansion and our renovation is $11 million, just over $11 million. And we're adding 17,000 new square feet to our building, and I'll show you the picture in a second. And then renovating the current space that we have to make it more functional. So this addition, the addition will add 5 new classrooms that will be mostly for workforce development and some college readiness classes. We'll have 5 new conference and meeting rooms. We currently have 1 meeting room for our staff, and we have a lot of confidential meetings that happen at the Institute. We'll become handicap accessible. We'll have 4 additional handicap accessible bathrooms with greater capacity and additional office space. So we have our design is complete. We're working with the firm Jim Dayton Design. So that design process is complete. And Mortenson Construction is the firm that will be doing the building of our project. So there's just a couple pictures on how tight our space is. A lot of our staff don't have their own desks, and they're really working in tight space. This is one of our staff's office on a cart because there's no place to put her. And one of our program directors' office is in a closet. So we're just out of space. All the creative solutions we have, we're out of. And this is a classroom, and so our classrooms are brimming, and they're too small. We don't have enough space in our classrooms either. So this is a picture of our building. It was built in the 1950s. It was built for light manufacturing on the first and second basement floors, and then the top floor was it was apartment building. So it was repurposed when we moved into the space in the 1970s, and has not really been touched since then. But we did add an addition, as you can see, kind of at the back of the building, that kind of higher space at the end. So the design for our new space is pretty great transformation, adding a lot of light to the building And so the new space is where you see that gray space in the beginning of the building going all the way back. And that's where all the new classrooms will be. That space is mostly classrooms. And then the old space will be mostly offices. And to do this expansion, we purchased a half an acre of land from the state fair with the governor's approval and his executive committee. Jerry Hammer from the state fair has really been a great partner of the Institute. They also own our parking lot that has over 160 parking spaces, and they lease that to us free every year. So I just can't say enough about what great partners they've been to the Institute, and they really support our work. I'm almost done here. So next, this is just an example of some of the new classroom space that we'll have that will be much more functional for our classrooms, upgrading our technology and the teaching tools that we have in our space. All right, and lastly, the request from the legislature is $5.5 million, and the Institute's share will be the equal amount of that, a match of that. To date, we've raised $4 million of that $5.5 million, so our fundraising is going very well, and we're optimistic that we'll have most of that money raised by the end of the summer. And as I just want to say that, as Alice has mentioned, the Institute, to my knowledge, has never come before this committee or from the legislature to ask for a set-aside, so this is the first time that will happen. We don't see us coming back to ask for more funding for maybe another hundred years. But I also want to say that I think the short-term investment is really going to have long-term gains for the community. So we have the graduates in our program that are out working and providing a tax base for the state, but also for their children who are seeing their parents move into professional positions and providing role models for their kids.
And so, Madam Chair, in both of these cases, these are organizations serving thousands of people. And even in these inadequate spaces, when you walk onto their campuses, both Avivo and the International Institute, you are inspired, and it is partly because of the leaders you've heard from today that you can feel the culture of support and warmth, and they're doing great things, and the success has overwhelmed them.
Thank you.
Yes, could I introduce Marie Denise Urizera? She is a graduate from our medical careers pathway.
Welcome, Urizera. Yeah, good morning. My name is Marie Denise Wizera. I am from Rwanda in Africa. I came here in 2005 with my two children to join my husband. He was already had asylum here. Then he took me to the International Institute. So now I work in a nursing home at the Link Brumisten Care Center in St. Paul for 13 years. I started there as a nursing assistant in 2006, and now I am a registered nurse, charge nurse on a transitional care unit. When I came in 2005, my husband took me to the International Institute. He said, I took my training here, you can do it too. Then I started. It was in September 2005. Then after I graduated, I got my job, and I continued to train at the International Institute because they have good programs. I wanted to go to college so I can have my degree. So I went to the college readiness, and I took classes like for 3 months. Then the program helped me a lot, as it helped many refugees and new immigrants in this country. I learned how the college system works here. I got to know how to find a college and how to register for classes. So I had many study skills from the International Institute. Then I started at St. Paul College, and it was easier for me, and every year I was on the dean's list. I graduated as a licensed practical nurse in December 2008 at St. Paul College. Later on, I pursued my schooling, and I graduated at the Minneapolis Community and Technical College as a registered nurse in 2015 with my associate degree. So the medical career pathway I followed at the International Institute of Minnesota helped me a lot during my schooling. They provided financial and emotional support, especially for when I was in college and during my early employment. I did not have problem like getting college books, and I was confident when I was going up and up, and that's how I was able to succeed. So I think you will support their project. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Gropman,
yes.
You acquired new land from the state fair. How much land did you have before you acquired that?
So the total amount of land that we have is about 1.8 acres, and we purchased 0.53 of an acre from the state fair.
And then can you tell us about the contaminated soil? Was that there before you got there, or was that, did you know that when you moved to there in the 70s, or which part of the land is contaminated soil?
Right, so no, we didn't know that before we started the project. So we had Braun Intertech do the soil studies. And so it's a small part. It's not the whole part of the soil for the building. It's probably a little over half of an acre of the soil remediation that needs to happen.
And what kind of remediation does it take? Do you know? Did they tell you that?
Well, they have to remove some of the soil and have it remediated and bring the soil back, but it doesn't have to be taken out of state to do that soil remediation.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Gropman. I mean, I just did some simple math, and, you know, $5.5 million just on the 2,700 people alone is just over $2,000 per person. And if you're moving people from, you know, $15 an hour wage jobs up to $30 an hour wage jobs, I think we get paid back in about a year and a half or 2 years. So it seems like a really, really good investment. And I just want to say how sorry I am to hear that your architect, James Dayton, passed away just a few days ago. The firm's a great firm with lots of great people, and I'm confident that they will take care of you, and the building that you've started down the path with will be a building that you end up with. So I'm sorry to hear about that.
Yeah, thank you so much. And Jim Dayton was very involved in the project, especially in the beginning stages. And Patrick Regan is the principal architect of the project, so we're in very good hands with him. But thank you so much. It was shocking and very sad for the project. He was very committed to the building, but also very much to the spirit of the project and the international aspect of it, and was helping with fundraising. But we expect that work to continue. So thank you very much. Yeah.
Representative Salk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. These questions are really just sort of like to have me be a little more understanding.
Sure.
Very much not evaluating the decision specifically.
Sure.
So you have two pathways? Is that what I'm – or are there other pathways that you're just not highlighting?
So we have two – we have other employment services, so what we call first jobs for new Americans.
Yep.
And then the pathways help people move up. But that's part of the need that we have is we hope to start a third pathway with more space, additional space.
Okay, thank you. Then, Ms. Chair, one other question.
Representative Salk.
To function this long, obviously you must have a fairly robust and loyal support base from which you're functioning. I'm aware of a parallel project, much smaller, but nonetheless very dependent on donor services and in-kind giving and all of that that makes this kind of project, but it's also an almost identical set of services to a identical group of people, but this is just functioning in Rochester. So I really do have a pretty clear understanding, but you didn't say at all about your how do we operate part of this? I know that you're focusing on the physical proposal, so.
Right, so the operational funding for our building, for our services?
Yes.
Yes. So our funding is grown more and more diverse, and that's really been a goal of the Institute. About half of our funding currently is government funding, but that funding is, some of that is passed through to the clients directly. But the other funding is foundation funding. We've really grown our donor funding significantly. In 2011, it was $14,000 a year. This year, it will be close to $400,000 a year. And also one great thing about doing this work is it's really gotten the name out, and we have more new funders as a result of the campaign work that we're doing. But we can never do enough of that, so we're continuing with that work. Representative Salk.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. I think this project, as Representative Dean underlined, these types of projects around the state actually end up rebuilding the state's budget more than depleting it. These programs go back online, and as he did his napkin type of calculation, we've got it in hard numbers through the system that I'm more familiar with. These kinds of operations take people that are otherwise needing direct support for the sustenance of their life and moving them into both taxpayers, people that are paying for all of their own services, they're getting health care through their new employer and that sort of thing. So there's a general swap of where we are placing people or allowing people to be. So there is nothing but a pure calculation benefit for these kinds of programs, and I support them incredibly.
Thank you very much, Representative Hausman, for bringing such outstanding programs before us.
Thank you.
We will hold these over for further consideration.
Thank you for hearing us.
Thank you.
First item on the agenda is Representative Joachim. And I think those of you that were on the committee before understand her project. But some of us haven't heard it at all. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and sorry about the tardiness. There was a car stalled in the tunnel.
So it's
always fun when 19 miles now. Take an hour and 20 minutes. So you all have a brochure in your packet I hope you pull out and look at. And I want to thank you so much, Chair Murphy and members, for the opportunity to present Perspectives Family Center, Bonnie Bill, before your committee today. So I know you have the rest of the agenda, so I'll make it brief. Perspectives, Inc., while based in St. Louis Park, provides regional service to homeless women and their children. It's been providing service for 40 years and has a wonderful track record. They provide supportive housing and clinical service treatment programs for mothers, as well as both academic and nutrition enrichment programs for children. Over the course of the years, they've outgrown their building in both space and services they need to provide to both mothers and their children. The total cost for Perspectives expansion project is $12 to $13 million, and the bill before you requests $4.5 million. In 2017, the project received a $600,000 pre-design grant from the state legislature and has put it to good use. The planning money has been spent, and the required plans, design, and specifications are now complete. The project is shovel ready to go, beginning construction in 2020 if the legislature chooses to approve the geobonding request in the bill this year. I would like to thank Tony, Representative Albright, for carrying the bill the last 2 years and helping usher across the finish line the planning money. I'd also like to thank the bipartisan support this bill has had in the past from Representative Hausman, Lilly, Hansen, Keel, Kreisha, and Uglum, and a few of our friends who've moved on to bigger and brighter things. I would also like to thank this year's bipartisan slate of authors in Albright, Winkler, Lee, Erdahl, and Jung, and currently Senator Sundgren's carrying it in the other body. I know you... I'm going to turn the rest of my presentation over to Karen Barton, the Community Development Director from St. Louis Park, who will quickly discuss the city's role in this bill, as well as Jeannie Seeley-Smith, President, say that fast a bunch of times, President and CEO of Perspectives, Inc., who will explain their program and what the project would mean to them.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Murphy and members of the committee. My name is Karen Barton. I am the Community Development Director for the City of St. Louis Park. And on behalf of the City of St. Louis Park, as the municipal sponsor, I am very pleased to express the city's wholehearted support for the mission of Perspectives and for this bonding request. You will also notice in the packet that you have, there's in that brochure, there is a letter of support from the mayor as well on the inside cover. Perspectives is and has been a very valued member of the St. Louis Park community for many, many years and provides much needed services to address the ever-increasing levels of homelessness and substance abuse in the city, metro area, and region. The city recognizes and values the great work that Perspectives does in helping mothers and children to heal trauma, restore dignity, and rebuild families through their supportive housing services, mental and chemical health programs, employment services, academic social skills and nutritional programs, and therapeutic early childhood development programming for homeless and at-risk children. And probably most importantly, giving all these mothers and children hope for the future. Through your support of this bonding request, Perspectives will be able to improve their facilities and expand their services to meet the ever-increasing demand for these critical services in the metro area and the region as a whole. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Seeley Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, for the opportunity to speak on behalf of Perspectives. For the record, my name is Jeannie Seeley Smith, and I am the President and CEO of Perspectives. As background, Perspectives is a 40-year-old nonprofit. Our mission is breaking cycles for total family recovery. And to that end, we operate the largest supportive housing, therapeutic supportive housing program for homeless women and children in the whole Midwest. If you will see on page 5, our housing campus. Annually, we serve 75 women and over 135 children. Now, it's important to note that the families we serve are coming to us straight from the shelter system and are considered by Hennepin County as the hardest to serve. In working with this population, we address our community's most pressing issues: homelessness, addiction, and mental illness, nutrition, family unification, racial disparity, and the achievement gap for young African American children. We have addressed these issues by recruiting over the decades a culturally diverse, multidisciplinary staff that includes case managers, mental health workers, teachers, dietitians, youth advocates, hundreds of volunteers, child care providers, and drivers that provide the transportation from our housing campus back and forth to our family center. Now, our family center is 1 mile down from our housing campus. It is the hub of our program that houses all of our staff and our services. We like to say it's where the magic happens, because that's at the site, the life-changing, intensive programs that create opportunities for mother and children to heal and rebuild are there 7 days a week. Our programming is based on best practices, a trauma-informed model that is designed to remove barriers and unlock the potential for women who have had extensive history of abuse and addiction, and for their children who have been the victims of its legacies, and consequently, the cycle continues unless broken. It is our family center that has brought us here today. There is growing evidence that homelessness is not solved by just providing a house. That to really make a difference in homelessness, that you have to address the core issues. Intensive services that we provide are around unresolved trauma and despair and abuse that our families have encountered. We have seen over 3 decades that it's the services that we provide from our family center that makes the difference from achieving our model, which is in, up, and out, to in, up, and back. However, our family center, through a viable building, still is no longer able to meet the growing needs of the families we serve. We are here today requesting your help in not only rebuilding the center, but to add 16,000 square feet to its expansion. As the brochure in front of you on page 12 and 13, you see 4,000 of that additional square feet will be designated for critically needed early childhood development programming. which I can say, coming from the front lines, that the most logical and effective area today to invest in our community's future is the impact in early in breaking that cycle is in early childhood development. Our program often, we work with kindergarten children, and our teachers will often say to us, I wish I would have had that child 2-3 years before. Because at 5, they are already showing major emotional issues. With this program in early childhood development, we will provide intervention for preschool children coming out of homelessness, coming many from shelter. Over 100 children will be served annually. The 50 preschool children that we have in our program right now who are being housed have no intervention to address their trauma. The barriers for them to get access to services are too big, so they slip behind every day. Our renovated and expanded family center will also expand and enable us to enhance our other programs that you see on pages 6 through 9. Our programs are highlighted there. So we'll be able to expand our Kids Connection program, our Kids Cafe program, our children's mental health services, our outpatient services for our women. As you know from the brochure, Seed the Change is a $13 million capital campaign, which we have raised over $3 million. $600,000 is Representative Yuka King just mentioned, was in a bonding bill that was passed in 2017. It has all been spent except for the construction documents, as you mentioned, and the building permits. The $4 million bond will ensure the completion of this campaign. If passed during this session, this time next year, we will be pouring the foundation for this building. In closing, I'd like to leave you with these outcomes. 84% of our families graduate into permanent housing. 92% of our students maintain or improve their academic performance around reading and math. 85% of our students improve their behavior significantly around our social enrichment programs. Over 50% of the women entering our program from shelter have open child protection cases. Over 90% retain the custody of their children. Again, I thank you for this opportunity to testify. And I wish to thank its author, specifically Representative Yuka Kim, who has been such a strong advocate, as well as the City of St. Louis Park for sponsoring our bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Juergens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Seeley Smith, on page 10, you briefly talked about this, the secured funding and the pending funding. And with the $4.5 million from state bonding, if you were to receive that, what's the status of the other $5 million that's pending? Are they holding on to that, waiting to see what happens with bonding, or how assured are you that that would come through?
Yeah. President Seeley Smith.
Madam Chair, Representative, that we have been in several conversations with the Peter J. King Foundation, and they have said, let us know when the bonding bill comes through. And they have discussed $3.5 million with us. Other dollars, $2 million from our community, we don't think is a stretch. We raise $600,000 with 250 people at our fundraiser for the last 3 years. $300,000 comes from the floor that night. So we know that we have a donor base that is well capable of giving us $2 million. And they, too, are waiting to hear on our bonding bill.
Thank you.
Representative Erdoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And am I correct in my understanding? Will this roughly double the number of people you can serve, or what percent?
We are.
Seeley Smith.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Erdoff. We are not an agency that will ever serve thousands. We are, over the years, we have served over 4,000 women in our supportive housing program and a number of children, 6,000 children. But we are always serving families very intensively. Right now, our housing program has 53 women and close to 100 children. So that program, once our family center is built, we believe that we will be able to expand our housing. So down the road, that is our goal. currently with our new family center, we will be serving 100 new preschool children with our early childhood development program.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Seeley Smith. What did you receive in the bonding bill last year in 2017?
Madam Chair, what did we see last year?
I bet you
2017. 2017 was when we received the bonding bill. We did not. We were not in the bonding bill of 2018, even though we tried.
Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In 2017, they were able to get a $600,000 cash grant to start with pre-design. And to also answer a little bit about some of the program that they'll be able to do, Ms. Seeley-Smith is way too modest about what this program does, and I've watched it in action. Not only do they have an 84% success rate, the children that they're serving right now have more barriers than ever before to reach their full potential. We're talking high ACE scores, trauma. They're finding over the years that they need more and more intensive services with the children because they're facing PTSD and a lot of other issues. So being able to have a bigger center will also be able to let them do a lot of the outpatient stuff that they need to do for the women that have already graduated from their housing. So they have women that will move out after 2 years and get into stable housing, get jobs, but they still need some of the services for the treatment and for their kids. So in a way, they will be able to serve more because they're going to be able to expand and serve their clients that they've had and keep them on the right path and keep that safety net underneath them.
Thank you, Representative Joachim. President Seeley-Smith, Ms. Barton, thank you for being here. We will hold this bill over.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Next item on the agenda is the Rural Wetland Replacement Program. Somebody took the jump drive. Couldn't even find one last night.
It was in the computer, and it's no. Oh.
Might have to wing it.
All right. Let's use handouts.
Flexibility. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, Angie Becker-Kadelka, Assistant Director with the Board of Water and Soil Resources.
All right. And?
Madam Chair, Keith Carlson, Executive Director of Minnesota Intercounty Association, also appearing on behalf of the Association of Minnesota Counties and the Minnesota County Engineers Association.
Okay. Ms. Kalutka, please begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the invitation to give a presentation on the background of the Local Roads Wetland Replacement Program. It's well known that wetlands provide multiple benefits. They act as a sponge, they filter out nutrients, protect water quality, slow erosion, hold water back, and provide for habitat. In the 1990s, the legislature enacted WACA, the Wetland Conservation Act, to provide for a no net loss of wetlands. This means that in Minnesota, first we must try to avoid wetlands, and where we can't avoid, we try to minimize the impact to wetlands, and where we can't minimize, then we mitigate. So one way that the legislature provided for this was in 1996 to put into statute requiring the state, through Bowser, to replace wetlands that have been disturbed by local road projects. So this could be local road projects from counties or cities or townships. So if they widen a road, and you'll see that one picture on the left-hand side, if they widen a road and that impacts a wetland, then the state is responsible for mitigating that wetland. The benefit. So local road authorities have appreciated the state being responsible because this provides for both the federal and state permitting requirements. So it's more cost-effective in that it streamlines permitting requirements. It also is quicker, it's more cost efficient, and it creates larger and higher quality wetland complexes rather than doing these little tenths of acres and trying to rebuild those on the sides of the roads. It allows the state to make larger and higher quality wetland impacts. If you look at the next page that has the map and the available credits, so funding levels have historically been lower than the program need, and what the Board of Water and Soil Resources has done in the past is we've tried to use multiple strategies to offset shortfalls. One thing we've done is we've borrowed credits from MnDOT, and another thing we've done is we've used credits that have been generated in one area, and so you'll see the different areas. They're called bank service areas. We've used the credits in one area to mitigate wetland impacts in another area. To the extent that this trading has occurred, we have to pay a penalty to meet a higher replacement ratio that's required by federal wetland permit requirements under the federal section 404, and that's administered by the Army Corps of Engineers. So one of the things that happens when we borrow from another part of the state, we spend down those credits quicker. You see over on the side, we've been running out of credits. We had to close two bank service areas last year, and the legislature passed a law to quickly open it back up again, so go ahead and spend down quicker so that no local road authorities were impacted by this. So we are spending it down quicker. And Mr. Carlson, I think you also have some information on more of the spend in the last several years. If you flip over to the next page about the needs and the appropriation. So in the past, we've only asked for what's needed to mitigate wetlands for the next 2 years. So we've always asked these on biennial basis. And those requests have not been able to be fully funded. And so we are not keeping up with the statutory mandate. So the implications is without sufficient and ongoing funding, local road authorities are the ones that are impacted most. It's the counties, the cities, and the townships that are going to be required to get their own individual permits now from both the federal and the state, which adds significant delays. They also have to find money then to pay for, to build, and to mitigate the wetland projects on their own. And so this could result in not only delays, but it could be canceled road projects. And finally, the last page of the handout shows an example. Imagine this in color. Shows an example of a wetland bank. And so this is in Murray County. It's called the Hanson Wetland Bank. It's 83 acres. And what this has done is this has taken local road impacts from, and I'm going to list them off here, Lincoln County, Pipestone, Wright, Anoka, Douglas, Kandy Ohi, Blue Earth, Grant, Ramsey, Dakota, Freeborn, and Lac-Qui-Parle counties to make this as a higher quality wetland impact. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Who's the banker? Or who takes care of the credits that are borrowed and paid back and stored?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, so Bowser acts as the banker. There's the wetland is created, and the state of Minnesota through Bowser holds an easement for those credits. Okay.
Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and welcome to committee. Ms. Kadelka, we've been talking some about 404 assumption here in the state of Minnesota. What impact would that have on the wetland banking program?
Madam Chair.
Kadelka.
Representative Torkelson, the potential of a 404 assumption would mean that the state could take all of those federal permitting requirements, and rather than having people go through two, so both a state and a federal, it's only going through one requirement. That is already in place for this program. So this program already has that in place. The 404 assumption might help it go quicker.
Representative Torkelson, I don't understand what 404 means.
Well, I'll just ask the testifier then to explain to all of us a little bit more about what 404 assumption entails.
Ms. Kadelka.
Madam Chair, members, so 404 assumption is a very uncleverly named piece, it stands for Chapter 404 of the Federal Clean Water Act. And so what 404 assumption is that the federal EPA is in charge of it, the Army Corps of Engineers implements it, and it's doing the wetland mitigation and requirements on a federal level. What assumption is that Congress has said that when possible, they want states to try to do this because it's going to improve efficiencies, it'll streamline, it'll be more cost effective. And so states have been encouraged to look at, can we do some of that permitting? Can we assume some of that from the feds to do the wetland mitigation impacts and replacements? To date, we have been going through a process of looking to see, is this possible to do? So this is a multi-year process. It's working with the Army Corps of Engineers and the Environmental Protection Agency to see if this makes sense and if it's possible and feasible to do. One of the things that we learned early on is that the Army Corps of Engineers said, when they did the analysis, they said, hey, we're going to keep about 90% of these associated wetlands. And we thought, well, that doesn't make any sense for the state. However, in the last 6 months, they've completely turned their opinion, and now they're saying, we think the state could take on 90% of what we've been doing as the federal government. And so 404 assumption, we are right now in the stage of trying to figure out for the legislature to make a decision of, does this make sense for Minnesota to pursue?
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair, if I could ask, expand on the answer. Representative Eklund and a bill co-authored by Representative Fabian has legislation that would take the next step on the path to 404 assumption. So that has been introduced in your House.
Is it moving?
Madam Chair, it was just introduced within roughly the last week and a half. It has been referred to Representative Hansen's committee.
Good news.
Madam Chair.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you. Thank you for that. Well, I don't know if you've ever had to deal with the Army Corps of Engineers.
Sometimes.
And was it a pleasant experience, Madam Chair?
The reception afterwards was. But that was several years later.
Yes. Well, I won't ask any more about the pre-reception activities, but I think, you know, there's an opportunity here for the state of Minnesota. It could impact much of the work we do around wetlands in a positive fashion, I believe. I think we have a good system in Minnesota that works well, could use some tuning up from my perspective to make it more efficient and more affordable. But 404 assumption would be a big step in the right direction, and I'm happy that you gave me a chance to allow these folks to talk about it.
Good. Any other questions? Representative Considine, or comments?
Thank you. Actually, my question's for Representative Torkelson. When you were chairing the transportation, as I recall, we were low, and you'd have a better idea, but as I remember, they were tens of millions of road projects, maybe hundreds of millions, that were going to grind to a halt when we didn't replenish this before. Is that correct?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Considine, that is correct to a degree. We need to keep money flowing through this so that we can keep these wetland mitigation processes moving forward. We did that, and you know, you can see here that we there's a continuing need for that. I would like to somehow make it a more affordable process so we wouldn't have to put quite so much money into it. And I think 404 assumption might help us actually accomplish that.
Thank you.
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair, representatives, again, Keith Carlson, Minnesota Intercounty Association, speaking on behalf of our organization, the Minnesota County Engineers Association, and the Association of Metropolitan Association of Minnesota counties. I just want to say that Ms. Kadalka did a fairly good job of identifying the legal requirements in current law. I would just like to expand on that a little bit. In 1996, when this legal obligation was created, this was at the very beginnings of the state's Wetlands Conservation Act. I think it's fair to say that there was nearly an open revolt going on within local government because of this new mandate that was being placed on them in addition to mandates that they receive from the Department of Transportation to build roads up to contemporary safety and design standards, and at the same time being asked to administer this very controversial law. The Wetlands Conservation Act is locally administered in Minnesota. So has a compromise because of the additional costs that were the local governments were being asked to accrue on both their road projects, as well as the requirement to administer the Wetlands Conservation Act. This program was come up as a compromise that the state would pay the tab on existing roadways for wetlands mitigations. The cities, the counties, the townships still retain the full cost of wetlands mitigations on new road projects. So I'm working from the document that's called Local Road Wetland Replacement Program Funding Needs, and as Ms. Kadalka indicated, we've been here before. In 2016, the agency gave notice to approximately 60 counties and the cities and townships located within them that they would no longer be able to meet the state's legal obligation to do wetland replacement on existing road projects. And I'll go into some detail more as to why that occurred. The response was the enactment of Laws 2017, Chapter 8, that one provided for direct cash purchases of wetland credits from existing wetlands banks operators, something that heretofore had never been done. The state had all, through Bowser, had always developed its own wetland banks. Secondly, in subsequent action in that session, and then again last session, additional bonding authority was provided to the agency of approximately $12 million to increase the capacity of the state's wetlands banks to meet its obligations. Unfortunately, that wasn't enough. We're coming into the 2019 construction season. Based on historic averages, the needs for credits, which is basically about an acre of wetlands to replace lands, wetlands that will be impacted by our projects on existing roadways, is about 170 each year. Right now, the existing wetland credits that are available at the Bowser banks is about 140, so they're about 30 short. They may be able to manage that for the coming construction season, depending on where the asks are from the individual counties, townships, and cities. They may come up short. So I will mention further that we once again need cash funding in addition to the bonding authority that has usually been the way to fund this program. Ms. Kadalka presented the same table that I have on page 5 of my document as to why we got here. Both past administrations and past legislatures have not funded the full request of the agency to meet the obligations there. As a consequence, again, they're going to be short. So what's the real need out here? The full need from discussions I've had with the agency is that they need about $26 million to become current. And there's two reasons for that. One, for the underfunding, but two, for the length of time it takes from when you provide the money to when a credit is actually available. Even though they may have spent the money to create the wetland bank, until the wetland is actually functioning, has a wetland, which takes from 2.5 to 10 years, depending on the specific project, it's not available for credits. So they have to kind of build up to get back to the pace where they have existing operating wetlands or functioning wetlands to meet the credits. So it's a quite large ask. As I've indicated, $5 million of that, because of this time lag, would have to be cash to meet up with the obligations. I'll just emphasize again the past administrations and legislatures' failure to meet these requests on a timely basis is costing the state more money than it should. a credit created through a Bowser-operated wetland bank based on information from about a year ago, cost about $18,500 per credit. When they go out on the open market to purchase it from private wetland bank operators, it costs $25 million, or if they enter into a cooperative development, $25,000. And if they enter into a cooperative development agreement with a wetland bank, private wetland bank operator, it costs them about $27,000. So they're paying a penalty from this underfunding. And then I'll just again reemphasize the point that Ms. Kadalka made. Part of the legislation that was enacted in 2017 that allowed them to borrow between these bank service areas incurs penalties. So instead of the normal replacement ratio of 2-for-1, 2 acres of wetlands for every 1 acre of wetland that's mitigated, the usual cost when that borrowing occurs is 2.5-to-1. An additional 25%. The agency estimates that that penalty is costing them about $1 million a year. So in short, Madam Chair, this is a critical funding need. It's been a long, over a 20-year legal obligation of the state. If you don't want your private contractors and their employees not to have work in coming construction seasons, this is a program that needs to be funded as soon as possible. I'll conclude with that.
Representative Juergens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Carlson, in 2017, half of the appropriation came from the general fund, $5 million. Was there any general fund dollars in the governor's budget that was released the other day?
In the current operating budget proposal from the governor's office, there was no operating or cash money that was proposed for this program. But this capital budget comes out next week. It's possible, nobody's told me at this time, that maybe cash is part of his capital budget proposal. That's possible, but I simply don't know if that would be the case.
Representative Narnas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Carlson, I notice on this one handout, I live in number four, I guess, district number four. And we have no credits. I know that we've got probably more highways and roads in my county than any other in the state of Minnesota, lots of water and needs. So I'm assuming here that, and I don't pretend to be an expert, zero means bad, right?
Madam Chair, Representative Norness, yes.
Yeah, what I thought you'd say. Okay. Well, I fully support, the need here. I had one other question, Madam Chair. It has to do with Bowser. I was involved kind of on the sidelines of a development, and Bowser Board has the authority to determine whether the wetland qualifies. In other words, in this case, it was wetlands and a replacement, according to state law, but they didn't think the replacement would be good enough, so they turned it down. I assume that's part of their authority to be able to do that. It also killed the project, but...
Ms. Kadalka.
Madam Chair, members, I'm not familiar with the project that you're talking about, but would be glad to look into it and talk to you and provide any information that I know of. The way that the law works is that it's a combination. It's a technical evaluation panel that includes the local governments, the SWCDs, and the Board of Water and Soil Resources to make determinations. So it's multiple folks making determinations. If this was for a local road project, if it qualifies, it's automatically in. So there's no other ranking, but it has to meet both federal and state requirements for it to be in.
Madam Chair, this was not a road project. This was a housing development. And they inquired whether they could appeal. I remember this. And they could. But they were told no one ever wins. So they chose not to. So just throw it out.
Ms. Kadalka, for development projects, does that go in the same bank and Bowser keeps track and charges back and so forth as the road banks?
Madam Chair, the road program is separate insofar as the money appropriated from the legislature is dedicated to local road wetland mitigation. The agency is also responsible to serve as that intermediary and banker for other wetland projects. And so sometimes they might be mitigated on the private market, and so there's private trading going on with those wetland credits. But we serve as the entity that holds those credits when somebody wants to either sell them or buy them.
And you're the bookkeepers, so to speak, mm-hmm. then. Okay. And that's charged to the developer, that's charged to whoever's needs the credits or needs the opportunity to store.
Madam Chair, if it's a private transaction, the state does not get involved with the dollar amounts at all. What we do is we take a look at how many credits and are those credits certifiable. So is what somebody did to create on their land, is that worth 4 credits or is that worth 3.5 credits? And then it's up to them and whoever is purchasing those credits to come up with the terms of the agreement of how much they're going to sell them for, how much this person is going to buy them for.
Thank you. Thank you very much. This will help.
Thank you.
Representative Schultz. Ms. Williams, Mr. Burton. House file 1066. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Please proceed.
Thank you, members, for hearing this bill. This bill, House Bill 1066, is a fix to an appropriation that Glenn Sheen received last session, so I appreciate that $4 million appropriation. We would like to be able to release those funds incrementally while we accumulate funds, non-state resources, donations, and other funding from the University of Minnesota, so we can undertake projects immediately once we have funds matched from the Minnesota Management and Budget Office. So initially the bill was written that we only funds would be released, the MMB total funds of $4 million, if we matched the $4 million appropriation. Now we would just like to release funds as we get a match from non-state funds to undertake various projects.
Seems fair to me.
Me too.
Representative Dean?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and your question seems fair to me. I'm thinking about the state. I'm thinking about the process we go through when we issue bonds. I'm thinking about, $150,000 component of the reconstruction versus a $1.5 million component of the reconstruction. And it just, it seems cumbersome. I've been on this committee now, this is my 7th year, and this is the first time I've heard of an ask like this. So I think we'd be setting a interesting precedent, and I don't know if Ms. Dyson or some of the nonpartisan staff would like to sort of chime in on what this sort of means. I'm assuming there's been some discussions that have taken place, but I just think for all of us as members, it might be good to have a little bit more description on what this entails.
Ms. Dyson, you're being asked a question.
Madam Chair, Representative Dean, I have the impression that phasing, and we talk about phases, and so I think that it has been done before. I can't point to a specific example, but what I would also mention is that funding is for bond-funded projects is on a cash flow basis. So projects, even if it's a lump sum, they might not need all of the money for the next bond sale. So a bond sale will list how many the agency goes to all of the state agencies that have the money appropriated to them for various purposes and say, how much money do you need in the next 6 months? But in the meantime, a state bond finance project can be fronted money from the general fund. So it's the administration of it is not the issue. So as long as it is a discrete phase and you're not building half of something, that is the biggest concern for bond counsel, is that it's not half of a building, it's you complete a discrete project or phase so that it's usable. That's the main concern.
Representative Dean.
Then a quick follow-up, Madam Chair. So if we're asking most projects to have their funding in place prior to that, oftentimes the projects themselves are able to deal with some of that cash flow as a project moves forward. And I'm wondering if this puts us in a different position where the state, I don't want to say is helping to facilitate the cash flow, but the state is helping to facilitate the cash flow on a project as it moves forward. I guess I understood exactly what you said, that we don't like, you know, if a project's a $5 million project and, you know, they have to pay a $1.5 million portion of that payment, we're not giving them all five, we're giving them one and a half. I certainly understand that. I'm wondering, and maybe this is to the bill author and to the University of Minnesota. I mean, are we talking $75,000? Are we talking, you know, $750,000? I mean, I'm just trying to think what this sort of looks like.
So I'll just tell you some of the projects that are on this list.
That'd be
so
great.
One is
Thank
the, a boiler replacement.
Excuse me a minute. Representative Schultz, what he's asking, he's talking about a project. And when you came before this committee before and the Glen Sheen tour took place, we didn't talk. It seems to me I heard many projects, several projects, not many, but several projects, individual things that had to be done over a period of time. They didn't all have to be done at the same time. And then the $4 million was granted, and it wasn't perceived in your ask in the first place, was it, that you had to have all $4 million matched at exact timing.
So, Madam Chair, ideally we would receive $4 million with no match. That would be the ideal situation, but that wasn't how the bill was drafted, and so it was drafted that the Glen Sheen and the University of Minnesota would raise money from private donations to do the improvements to the facility and the grounds, and so initially, it would have been probably better to do that incrementally, where as we received those private donations, we could undertake a project, because then it would be easier to continue to request donations as they saw improvements in the property and they saw their money being used to improve the property, which would also increase visits and revenue for the estate. But some of those projects, so one is $1.7 million. This is in the list of some priority projects. It's boiler replacement and the heating system. The second one are site structure improvements, the garden walls and the terrace. That's $3.1 million. So these aren't small dollar amount projects. The second one is improving the carriage house, which is like the boathouse that's right on the lake, the only one on Lake Superior. That's $1.4 million. And then the manor house itself, improving that, that's $1.8 million. So we have huge retaining walls that are failing. There's a big historic fountain there that's tilted. And so there just needs to be, so we can preserve it, an investment in this estate that we haven't really, we've really neglected. The university's really sort of not invested because of lack of funds. And now we have donors that we would like to request funds from and get some matching dollars from the state to start implementing these projects in phases.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Schultz. It gives me a little bit less sort of wondering about what you're talking about. I think that sort of sets it real clear. And, you know, most renovation projects of this type do tend to be broken up into pieces. I was just sort of curious what those pieces might be and what they might look like. So thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Representative Constein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is actually just something I remember from before. And wasn't there also the pier? Wasn't that also a big project? Is that has that been done? I don't hear you talking about it.
So, Madam Chair.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So that's the carriage house improvement piece the pier. It's not on there, but that is there is a cement structure that needs to be fixed.
Protects the front of the.
To fix to protect the boathouse. So there's a long concrete pier that we would like the Vista Fleet Cruiser to pull up to as they cruise Lake Superior and have people tour, but they can't do that until we fix the pier. That's not on the list, but there's lots of other projects that they would like to do a study and prioritize. That's another project that needs to be done. So there's a lot more work than just $4 million.
Okay.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think Representative Schultz has done a good job of explaining the needs that are there. I think a very valuable project to get work done on. I did help to broker this arrangement in the first place. And the deal was that, you know, the state could provide $4 million, but that the University of Minnesota then, through various means, was responsible for raising the other $4 million. And we were in a situation where nothing could happen until the University of Minnesota raised the $4 million. They are doing it, but it's taking a little bit of time. And therefore, the purpose, I believe, of this bill is to allow for expenditures to begin in a prorated rate until the other money is raised. So this allows them to get going and doing something while we are awaiting the full amount to be raised by the state of Minnesota. So I certainly support this and think that we should allow them to do that.
Representative Sandstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is really an important thing to let them get going on this, because the longer we wait on these projects, the costlier they become, which is, in my opinion, not a great use of our state dollars when that happens. So when we have a match and we're ready to go, I don't know why we would want to see things deteriorate longer or not use our dollar efficiently.
Thank you very much. We will hold this bill over.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Ms. Williams. Okay. Members, in your packet are the minutes. Representative Sandstick.
Madam Chair, it looks like we have minutes from February 14th and February 19th, and I move those.
Yes. The representative Sandstick, the minutes from the 14th is a correction. Representative Cantrell was here, and so we want to make that correction on the 14th. And then the minutes of the 17th is as printed. 19th.
As printed, yes, ma'am.
14th and 19th.
I move the minutes.
All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Minutes are accepted. Next week, there's a possibility of an evening meeting on Wednesday. We have to hear all the projects. We can't go into a deadline time period where we haven't got at least 10 minutes of knowledge about all the projects that we have to consider, and they're not in our possessions. And so we have to have informational hearings, 10 minutes kind of stuff. And if we've got them all, if we can do them all in the morning, that's great. But if we can't, and I heard from staff that I have to keep my questions limited. So be it.
Yes. Madam Chair, can we actually limit the presentations to 10 minutes apiece rather than 15 minutes so that we can hear more in the morning?
I'm going to try that.
Okay, thank you.
We're going to try that.
Madam Chair, just as a reminder.
That means with questions.
Madam Chair, just a reminder, we have lots of committees starting to meet in the evenings, and people are going to be testifying, so
I know
it's going to be, we're going to see members going in and out, so just a reminder that there may be times where we might not see as many people at this table as we would ideally like to see.
I know, it's kind of like it'll be 7:50 all the time. This meeting is adjourned. Have a good weekend.